six, seven, eight, nine, 10.
First of all, you were Southern Regional Director for the National Urban League. And what years were you that?
Let's see. 68 or 70 or something. 68? Mid-60s to 78.
Mid-60s, 64, 65? And were you any on any other positions that you were held during this
time? Prior to the Southern Regional Director job, I was Deputy State Director of Atlanta.
Okay. What year was that?
I was there and graduated from the University.
Yeah.
I was associated with Grace Mountain.
Sure, that's great.
You spoke to her.
Yeah.
And I stayed in that job until the 70s, in the 60s. A low point. So I was elevated from the job as executive director of the Atlanta Urban League, which is my first job after I graduated from the university, and became the regional director in the mid-60s. And I stayed the regional director of the Urban League then until 72. Moved to New York as vice president for field operations. Stayed in New York in that post when the former Jordan was also from Atlanta.
Yeah.
Until 79. Came to Atlanta in 79 as a dean of the Baptist Student Social Development.
But you
stayed there until 2 years ago. And I'm now the president of the community, consultant of the Community Service and Cooperation.
But the regional director thing was in about 65 to 72.
Mm-hmm.
How about you were on the steering committee of Action for Democracy? You remember that at all? What was that? I'm not sure it was either.
I'm not sure it was. I'm not sure about that. We'll come back to him and talk to him.
Okay. One of the main things I wanted to talk to you about, when I spoke to Robert Flanagan, he mentioned that there had been an agreement made between black and white leaders in the 60s, right after the Peyton Wall incident, that the blacks would take over all of the southwestern MLK to that Chattahoochee River, and that that area was to begin over to black expansion. Do you remember any kind of agreement like that? It wasn't a written agreement, I'm sure, but it was. Remember any kind of verbal agreement?
Something called ACA, maybe what you mentioned, Action Integral, something called ACA, the Atlanta Committee for Cooperative Action.
Yeah.
That was ACA. And ACA was an organization of black leaders who felt there was a need for an independent group of professionals to assess the problems relating to black and white relations in Atlanta. And we ought not to identify with any other organization, we ought to deal across the board. I served as chairman of ACA for a time. And ACA, that sort of a think tank in the black community, decided there was a need for an organization to address the overall concerns, and we set up another organization called the Atlanta Summit Leadership Conference. I served for a time as chairman of the Atlanta Summit Leadership Conference. It was that group that decided there was a need, working with Mayor Allen at the time, to deal with major black concerns. ACA, before the summit, we were set, did do a rather exhaustive study of the problems in Atlanta called, that might have been Action for Democracy, that might have been what we wrote a proposal, we wrote a statement of black concerns, and we issued that report. Matter of fact, we got published, would you believe, in the Moscow Journal on that.
Really?
It was an identification, and they have one, I don't know now, this is my second day here. Before. It's called Action for Democracy, I believe, and it was an effort to identify the problems facing black people, and we identified problems in the education field, in the employment field, in recreation, and in housing. And we issued that report. We had a meeting at the 100 Club for the Y18 YMCA Forum, which at the time was the only forum that black and white folks could comfortably meet together, or still does, and that was a great concern. Do we issued that report, and after that report was issued, we recommended, we determined there was a need for a more criminal homegrowing organization becoming a little bit more directly involved in the social dynamics of land and racial open. So we set up this, this summit leadership conference, working through the local land urban league and the regional urban league, where I was serving in as a deputy by the subdivision office. We have convened a group of citizens, and we determined that there was a need for this summit conference. Five of us decided that we would be the ones that would convene the black leadership of all known organizations in the country. And the five of us, as I recall, Hugh Williamson, who was the problem, you know, who died last year, the first black member of the city council of the Roy Johnson, who became the first black senator, that's what we A.T. Wallman, who was a senior lawyer in the community, if I recall. And there may have been, I believe, a student at the university and a group of young activists, or radical, not the right word, but a very, very aggressive organization. The five of us got together and sent out a letter to about 200 different organizations, which composed a black membership, invited them to what we call the summit conference, bringing the leadership together, like I've heard of them this happening in Tokyo. We invited the medical association leaders, the student groups, the neighborhood groups, the legal groups, whatever. Any organization we could identify that had a structure, we invited them for the IQC, the interdenominational theological center. And we developed the agenda. We thought we'd take our shots at we were just delighted at the response.
The summit group was an umbrella group for everybody.
Yes. We invited about 200 groups to come, and the whole idea of convening that group was to see if we couldn't follow up what ACCA, the United Committee for Cooperative Action, had done in terms of that action for democracy and peace, and do a much more comprehensive statement and set some machinery for dealing with race relations around across the board. ACCA had determined, we were young Turks at the time, I can use that term too freely now, but then we were not a part of the structured leadership, primarily at the time of the Atlanta Negro Voters League, which was a very active entity at the time, and we were not satisfied with the thrust and the drive.
Well, Roden was part of that.
Yeah, he was part of that group, but that didn't bother us. He was a part of the summit, because we needed him to help us convene the group, we felt. But we still didn't think that the voters' leg was really moving in the direction we wanted to, nor as fast as we wanted to, and with the vigor and the dynamics that we wanted to move. And while Roland was one of the five who convened that group, we had this kind of a meeting, which I think is rather historically significant. But not a new dimension. We wanted to know, we had a meeting to determine if there was one black people person in Atlanta whose signature would be powerful enough to bring the black leadership together. So ACCA, this group that I mentioned earlier, we met, and we struggled with that question for the whole meeting. Is that one name we could use to demand people's attention? We could not come up with a name that we thought would serve that purpose. That's why these five people that I mentioned and calling the summit together were chosen. You could not find one black. There were two who came close at the time, John Wesley Dobbs and A.T. Wallman, who thought might be the one Republican and one Democrat. We finally decided, though, we ought to go with the people I named a minute ago.
So ACCA led to calling together the five people.
Right.
It led to calling together the summit group.
Right. And we convened the summit group. And we called the Atlanta the Summit Leadership Conference, what it's called. We institutionalize it, we formalize it, but it is.
And this is the group that now goes to Mayor Allen and next.
Right. So we had the meeting over at ITC, met on a Saturday. We had old people, young people, neighborhood people, top leadership came to the meeting. We suggested at the outset that we ought to have certain areas, following what ACCA had done, we had a workshop, we had general statements made about why we're here, and the purpose was to review the whole spectrum of black interests and concerns quite interesting concern, and how can we develop a mechanism to build a better working relationship with our community. And we made those general statements, then decided we divide up a group, just a couple of people in your team that morning. We thought that was historic and unique. We had to go out 10 o'clock Saturday morning. And $1 registration fee, as I recall, $1.50 at most, and that was for lunch. So we sent out bought lunch for everybody and had it there at the place. We were just so delighted, and even the last 10 o'clock that morning, we didn't break for lunch, it just went right on through.
So somebody became a big organization.
Yeah, they did. Right? The guy in the company in a minute, he was the head of the social department at the university. The University of Michigan, I came to town 2 months ago, was designated as the historian, the best word I come up with now, to take the report from each one of these workshops, which came back to a plenary session in the afternoon, to identify their concerns and actions that needed to be taken. And we put all those reports together, put it together for us, and we issued this statement. I don't recall the name of the piece. We came up with a little piece as we came over ACCA with that little printed booklet. And that became the Black agenda for the decade. We decided that we would, once we were pulled together, we would present the Black agenda to the ruling class, the citizenry of the town. So we called Mayor Allen and told him we'd like to have a meeting with him to discuss some matters of major concern regarding the Black and White and the growth and development of Atlanta and the importance in our judgment of a partnership between Black and White people. And we'd like to meet with him. And we did have one meeting with him. Our proposition to him was we want him to convene a meeting at City Hall. And we wanted that meeting in City Hall to include the following kinds of people. We wanted a Hotel Owners Association. We wanted the Restaurant Owners Association. We wanted the Chamber of Commerce. We wanted members of the Board of Education. There are no Blacks on the Board of Education at the time. One of the members of the city council, and I think, I'm not sure if QB Williams was on there, so either one black member.
He was on, he's about 65.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure whether he was on at that particular meeting or not. Anyway, we wanted the Medical Association.
Yeah.
We wanted the General Association. And other groups like that in our judgment control the various aspects of life in Atlanta.
And there's all the people holding you back, really.
That's right. And we brought leadership. We wanted to meet with them. It wasn't a confrontation so much as a kind of develop a partnership. And we wanted him to call all the white people, and we call all the black people. And we wanted to come to City Hall, and we wanted to deal with, present our agenda to that group. He did. He responded positively. We met with him. I was one of those, along with all of the five of us who convened the week earlier. We made our presentation. And the mayor was very astute, I just want to mention that. He thought it was a good idea for us to talk together, and decided that one way to move forward was to establish some integration committees to deal with each one of those concerns. As I recall, the public accommodation law did not become effective until 64, 65. And so we had a problem with restaurants. The first restaurant, as I recall, that opened the door to black people was Heron's Restaurant.
Yeah.
Julian Bond had been part of the SNCC over there, and they had been trying to be picketed in SNCC, and I'm not sure about this. I think Jose Williams might have been part of that too. Julian Bond led the leadership, but I'm not sure if he's a student. And the whole idea that we get the hotel owners and the rest of the others to agree to open their doors, there were no black members of the Chamber of Commerce. Mm-hmm. So it was a complete different world.
That's why more and more, because there were really two cities that were operating separately.
That's right. That's right. And we met, and we began to, develop some understandings about it. So we learned, in other words, we had, I was on the committee, as I recall, that met with the Chamber of Commerce. And we met at the Commerce Club. And we use that occasion to talk about the restricted membership, to talk about the restricted opportunities in the economic world and so forth, and begin to make some move in the right direction. The most important aspect of that will not be we opening up of a hotel or a restaurant, which did result in the full public conversation bill to pass, but building a line of communication and a partnership and talking about the issue. So that was really the beginning of a real broad-based effort to try to bring about a political partnership between black and white.
And so the whites were agreeable to sharing power a little bit, at least opening things up.
Prepared to talk about it. And that was a good beginning. But prior to that time, there had been no black members, as I call, of the Chamber of Commerce. I believe Jesse Hill, who was very active in this, and then Russell later on came in, as I recall, and both of them were, of course, in the second blacks to be presidents, I believe, of the Chamber of Commerce.
What do you think Allen's motivation was? His votes?
Hmm?
Mayor Allen's motivation. Do you think he was after votes, or just the goodness of his heart, or...
I think he looked at himself, first of all, as a wealthy man, independent man, and a hard-nosed man, and a leader of the white community, and he's big enough to be different. He could meet with us without being hurt, or some other person, white, might not have had the strength or the feeling of compliment. I think Allen felt that I'm as good as anybody in town. I'm the mayor of the people. They know I represent them. And just because I talk with blacks, they don't know to do me in, because they know if I go behind doors, I'm going to say the right thing.
Well,
I think he's a part of it, part of the structure, he's a leader of it.
Yeah, well, he was elected with some with black votes.
He did, that helped.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, but beyond that, there was some goodness. I think that when he built that stone wall on the that was crazy, and he later recognized that. Now, as I recall, he did go to Washington and endorse the civil rights bill, as I recall. But I thought that he was open-minded and willing to discuss it. He was not afraid of himself, felt very good about himself. So I feel comfortable in working with a man like that who feels so confident that he could open up any door. I mean, mm-hmm. Nobody would turn down the telephone call from Ivan Allen, whether he's mayor or not, because he was in some power in there.
How about the other ones? Were they willing to open up doors? Richard Rich, for example, you had trouble with him, didn't you?
We had trouble with Rich's, and we chose Rich's as a point of the confrontation. As I recall, we, Borders, I'll name some names for you, Borders is one of those. We had a meeting of this, of our summit group on occasion. We had many of our meetings at the Atlanta Life Insurance Company, because not a lot of places we could meet. Atlanta Life was owned by black people, Jesse Hill was there, so that wasn't a problem. And I remember on occasion, it was very, very interesting. By that time, I worked for the National Urban League as a deputy director. And Borders made a speech to us and said, you know, we've been talking, let's quit it, and let's go to Richard and go down that right now. We were down Auburn Avenue, you could walk. I wasn't sure if that was a policy of the National League. I was on the National League payroll when Regional Director in Atlanta. A guy named Poirier was the director. I was his assistant. And we said, you know, what they are, you know, regardless of what the national position is on picketing, we think this is the thing to do and the time to do it. So we all marched out of Richards, and I guess we did it in a couple of days. No arrests were made. One or two did go inside. So that was the beginning. Continuation of dialogue, keeping the pressure on it.
But how about this agreement? Do you remember anything at all about this agreement made after the Peyton Wall thing that in a sense the city would agree to a certain part of the Southwest going over to the black population expansion?
That's not the way I would recall it. I would say that while you couldn't sign any manifesto, I think the general feeling was that the mayor figured he was strong enough. Black people live, this is the line between black and white,
right?
White people over there and black over here. Blacks, you go this way, and you buy it up here, and we don't think that's right, he was saying. I think he felt he's big enough to make that operate. And then he built that wall on this street, which is the main street. He said, I'm big enough to do it. He's a powerful man. And when I remember my church, I remember Friendship Baptist Church, a man named Sam Williams, was a very powerful guy. And after church one day, we decided to go and have church service on those rails. That's pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah.
Sam Williams, very articulate, very able, very aggressive, unafraid. And the mayor recognized, I'm sure, as soon as he told him to put the damn walls up there, that just didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And he was laughed at. I mean, after a while, even his friends said, well, you can't put up
more.
You can't put a bridge across the damn street, Mayor. So I think he laughed at himself out of that.
But you don't remember any particular verbal agreement about
it may have been understandings that he took the thing down as if to say, well, we don't have any legal right to do that. Don't sell. And if black people come in and offer you, say, you don't have to sell your house. If you want to pay what they want to pay, I think they just probably wouldn't sign an agreement. I think you just said it's a lost battle.
In other words, you're saying this area's opened up.
I would say that's right.
If you try and save this area for whites, the area's now opened up.
That's right. I think there's sort of an understanding. And the same thing when I came back to Atlanta, I went to Clark College in Atlanta. I went to AU later.
Yeah.
But I moved out. I was on the west side of town. And it was trying to think of the name of it. Something like the Natchez. You really have a sign, a zigzag sign, something like that, over on Paynes Avenue where I live now, North Avenue. And the blacks were moving in that area. And my wife and I came back with one child from the military down in Cleveland, Georgia. And we bought a house over there. And it was really rough. We were riding around in cars and loudspeakers, frightening young people. You would think it's the Nazis all up again. They didn't try to hide it. They were popular with that little segment of racists that operated. They're trying to stop it. They're trying to put signs up, blacks don't move. But the same thing happened with that segment as it happened with the mayor. You just can't put up a sign. If people want to sell. And when black people come in a society which has for the last 200 years kept black people apart, white people follow white people, black people follow black people, and it's been social, economic, and cultural and religious thing to do.
Yeah.
So when King calls 11 o'clock Sunday morning, we'll say it out in history. I think this is true. It's true now. It's true then. But you can't draw that line. So I think the line is that it just won't work. What? I don't think the folks are so good about it. It just didn't make sense. The white person sold the house, they want their money. Go to Grant County.
So Allen pretty much, he didn't say, but he pretty much gave you the inclination that the area's opened up, I suppose, right? He didn't actually say
this. It was not a proclamation of open occupancy. It was sort of a despair that I can't do anything about it. I'm sorry. That's the way I see it.
Okay. How about the attempt to move blacks out of the south side, you know, with building a stadium, for example? And if you wanted the stadium was put there because of an effort to get blacks out of that area down there?
I think it was put there because it was that would be one factor. I think race I think economics would be a primary factor. It's a part of a town that would be as economically feasible to obtain. The blacks didn't have the political power, so that wouldn't be a problem. The space was there. Accessibility was a factor, close to downtown, get real from it. So I think black is just insignificant. I think the economics is just so obvious that they just want
to... I heard that there was a desire there, the desire to drop leaders to put a black project there. And to block that, Allen put the stadium there. I mean, it might have been economically feasible and all that, but it was a desire pretty much to put a barrier in between the downtown area and the south side
block. That would seem a reasonable political decision we made at the time. Yeah. I'm not conscious of the details of that organization. But I was in very much in line with trying to keep the black and white people apart.
Yeah. How about the effort to shift blacks to the west side to the building of the projects? Since most of the projects might have wound up on the west side.
Mm-hmm.
Not on the north side, not in the northeast. Do you think that was a conscious policy also?
I think the question that was true, and I think it was also very conscious on the part of the Board of Education. My wife's school teaching time, and children went to public schools there most of their life. I think it was unquestionably the desire on the part of the leaders of the town. It wasn't just the mayor versus the Board of Education. I think it was the white people of the town that made certain determinations. One was, in order to delay forever the integration of schools, to build a black school for all the black people having to be. They build schools all over the damn place, small schools. So if black people are here, build a school here. And if white people are here and blacks are here, You'd build one in the middle of the black community, and they would tend to go to the school closest to them.
So
the fight for integrating the schools would be less and less, and that worked a long
time. Now, why would that be? In other words, put the school right in the middle of the
black
white
community.
Or the white or the black community.
Well, if the black folks start moving west to where white people were and raising the question 10 years from now about going to black schools, it built a school in the direction that black people were going. There's one good example on, I think it's Hollywood Road, which will come to me in a minute. It built a beautiful school. I worked at the local urban league at that time, and I got a call from the people, and they were telling us how proud they were to have the school out in this neighborhood. And we went out. They said they did have a problem. They had a problem with traffic. And could the local urban league help them, these black people, to deal with it? And he said, of course. I'm the community organization worker, that's my field, with the local urban league. I've been in training, and now my job is to respond to the needs of the black neighborhood. As I go out and meet with them on Sunday afternoon, they said, you know, we have a beautiful school, we love that school. It's our own school. We have a committee that cuts the grass, we rake up the stuff, and our children like to go, and the teachers are nice, and it's ours. We named it, and we feel good about it. And we did help them to get a ride on the corner. But we did suggest they ought to organize themselves in order to be able to deal with the problems of the children in a more meaningful and systematic way. And we asked them some questions about the quality of that school versus what happened at the white school, which is already that old school.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous when they started looking. They didn't know the questions to ask. No, the reading level of the first of the sixth graders when they leave the black school versus the reading level of the whites is just a few blocks away. And then had conceptualized and trying to evaluate that school in that way. I also found out that many of the black teachers didn't want to go, who were middle and upper class blacks, didn't want to travel out to this isolated neighborhood for the black school, although new. So they didn't have much to do with it. So PTA meetings were not all that popular, and the blacks didn't feel comfortable in working in the neighborhood. So you had a cultural and economic great difference between the black teachers and the black people in the neighborhood. And so the teachers that were sent to these schools, since they were undesirable locations, the teachers who were not doing so well in that place, that turned out to be a very, very bad scene. And we learned that when we had meetings. I'm representing urban leading in the meetings. The teachers didn't care, and they'd get out, they'd get there in that lovely crowd and get out of there, they'd assume the school was out.
Because the neighborhood was better?
Yeah. The city wasn't doing anything about it. It was just a dead end, just a group of blacks. All we had, you had poor black people out there, and the teachers live over here, you understand how that is. And they said, well, they didn't want to be bothered with it. So the poor blacks, we get them women. And there's no effort of the white superintendent of the school I was at the time to deal with that situation.
Well, what could he have done? What could he have done?
What could he have done? It was a woman.
What could one do?
We raised a question with the Board of Education. We asked this question, why did they build a school in the first place? They said they built a school right before school. Well, people were there, they built schools that people needed. Actually though, when we got a map of the city of Atlanta, which we did when we were doing assessment of the location, census tract by census tract, it was pretty obvious that the schools were being built and the schools with all the drawing boards were really designed to protect segregated schools, not to build an education system that's going to need for black people. And we moved toward integrating the school system. That's what we did.
Now, let me just get this straight. The black schools, you say, were put in areas where the Board of Education thought blacks were moving to where they wanted them to move to, is that it?
And to keep them from moving, which the direction of the country, if it tend to move toward some kind of integrated proposition sometime in the future, the best way to avoid that would be to have blacks to have their own school.
Okay, so in other words, they keep the blacks from moving towards the white neighborhood.
They build a school for the blacks, rather than white folks. When the black got older, they had to close up the school. They're still closing them up because they don't go to that. They build a school to keep the blacks in their place. And later, during the integration days, it's just inconvenient for blacks to go. That's how the whole busing system came about. Because they were busing blacks from here to integrate because the white people are going someplace else. It was a design, the plan. Somebody upstairs had planned a very beautiful
so
school to keep black folks apart.
Okay, Barstools were built to protect the segregated schools,
right?
They were built to keep blacks from, well, they were keep blacks from moving towards the white neighborhood schools. And the Barstools were put in certain directions, put in certain directions.
Right.
And
to protect the segregated system.
So otherwise, the blacks would not come near the white neighbors because they could not go to the white school.
Right. And also another consideration is that, you know, is the transportation system.
Yeah.
It all was designed to keep blacks going this way, white people going this way, and so you set up a system to keep them apart.
Oh, and
they've done that. It still works.
Is it the bus system?
What? I didn't mean the bus system. I mean the various designs and schematics in order to keep the black and white from having to work together presents a real problem. I'm on the Marta board, for example.
Yeah.
We're discussing right now, off the record. Boy, I'm on the record. The employment pattern of blacks and whites in Atlanta was such that in City Hall, beginning with that's when I became more active in this, was that the city employment structure and the management and control of City Hall was so predominantly in charge the white community, that black people didn't always feel comfortable going to City Hall. The Urban League, as a matter of fact, had a person on the staff who in the area of job development and employment. And we had an arrangement with the City Hall that if they would send us applications for employment and we would refer people to City Hall, they were so comfortable with our selectees, they would hire most of the people we would refer to them. But we'd only know about jobs that they were willing to have blacks in the first place. So we sent a committee to meet with Mayor Allen on this matter of job opportunities in City Hall to give you a flavor of the tone of the race relations at the time. And we asked the mayor, I was an urban legal, I was a chairman, or not chairman, I was a staff person working with the committee, to explore new employment opportunities in the city of Atlanta. And the mayor said, you need to tell me that you're ever telling us that we discriminate against black people in the city hall? He said, yes, sir. That's why we're here. We want a job opportunity. He said, if you want a job in City Hall, you take the examination like everybody else. You pass the examination, you get the job. He said, well, listen, man, we don't think it works that way. He said, oh, yes, it does. So he called the personnel director in. And he repeated this to him. But these people said, it was about 10 hours. These people said that we discriminate. Explain that to me. I will not allow, the mayor said to him, any discrimination against anybody, certainly not black citizens of Atlanta, for any job in City Hall. Now, what do you do about that? He said, well, mayor, we advertise a job. Everybody knows about it. And anybody wants to pass examination, you get the top three names, you send the three names to the department head, and the department head has a right to choose one of those three. And I've been here, what, 4 or 5 years, I don't have anything in my record indicating any black person been discriminated against.
Where they advertise it? Where they advertise the drugs?
What he said was, well, we advertise them in a newspaper, he said. He just said in a newspaper, we put it, they read it, everybody reads the same, everybody gets the same information at the same time. Yeah. That's the way he put it. And the man said, you heard what the man said, what about it? We were ready for something like that because we did have a professional staff person. In this case, it was myself and the person in charge of job development for the local Urban League that could really try to get the facts. So we said, you know, we appreciate it, Mr. Mayor, but would you have any objections if we would do a little study of the matter for you and then bring the findings back to you and then you take a look at what we find if you make the information available to us? He said, listen, you're citizens like anybody else on the middle of town. This is an open city. You take it, go with it. He told the personnel director, give them anything they need. He did a 5-year study of job employment practice in the city of Atlanta. Let me give you an example of one of the findings that makes the point. I think there were 27 departments we looked at. We wanted to know whether it was race, sex, salary, job classification, and turnover rate, one of the key questions I recall. We thought we'd take a good look at sanitary departments where the opportunities for employment for blacks might be a little bit better. We found a problem. I think there were 250 trucks, garbage trucks. 5 garbage men were assigned to each one of the trucks. We found a problem. Of the 250 trucks, there were about 200 drivers of those trucks. the driver of the truck was a supervisor of the crew of garbage men. Now you don't have to go to the back. Then you go to your backyard and get the garbage, put it on the shoulder, bring it to the truck, and dump it in. Over the five-year period that we studied, there was a turnover rate for the truck driver, who's a supervisor, who kept a record of who you worked and the number of hours. You had to put down the name, the number of hours, and multiply time and get up and calculate his money for the day, turn that in the end of the day. That was the mathematical skill that a person needed. I'll come back to that in a minute and discuss the test that you have to pass. And we found that over a five-year period, the turnover rate was 60%. 60%. Not one black person had been hired as a truck driver in the sanitary department during the five-year period. All were white. Five men were signed to each one of the trucks, so five times 200 trucks, whatever number that is. The turnover rate had not been as high. It was a surprise to learn. The turnover rate had been lower, we found out later, because black folks didn't have opportunities. Once he got a job, even a garbage truck driver, he kept his job. Turnover rate 30%. During the five-year period, not one white person was hired as a garbage collector in the city of Atlanta. Not one in the five-year period. We checked the water department. We got put out of the water department. We went down to talk to the man who ran it at the time, a man named Paul Weir. We called him Paul Weird after that. But he stood up and dismissed us when the committee went to him to talk about this matter. At any rate, water meter readers, they use a lot of Georgia Tech graduates in the summer and during the year to read water meters. Blacks represented about, what I call, 37% of the population at the time. And they had part-time workers and others to read these water meters. You go up to the front house, it's a sidewalk, you know. You got a proof, you open up the meter, you write down the amount of water you use, put it in your book, and you go. So there's no interaction between the household and the person. I don't recall the number, but anyway, whatever number they needed, maybe 300 that they needed at the time, part-time work of Georgia Tech, because they had engineers and others, they just assumed that was a good place to find people to move about this thing. Not one single black person with four undergraduate schools, five universities, and five schools, and seven in the university center, had been hired during a five-year period to read not one water meter reader in a five-year period. We found that black women had all the jobs cleaning the white women's toilets, the black men working the city hall cleaned the black men's toilet, cleaned the floor, and that kind of always across the board in every department.
Yeah.
The jail aisles or whatever it was the city owned, hospitals and so forth. And we had that report. We went through 27 departments.
Yeah.
And we took it in and showed it to the men. Where'd you get this information from? He said, we got it from your personal information. Go get it, he called me. Did you give these people this? Yes, sir. Is that accurate? He said, yes, sir. He said, well, doesn't that seem a little strange? It's strange, Mr. Mayor? Nothing strange about it. As I told you, these jobs are available. We publish it. If the blacks don't want to apply for a job, if the whites don't want to apply for a job as a garbage, I can't make them apply. It's an open. This is a public institution. And you wouldn't allow that, Mr. Mayor. And I wouldn't either. I'm your manager. Mayor was very pleased for one time. He said, you know, he dismissed all these staff people and he said to us, this is very revealing. And I'll tell you what I would do. I think that we ought to try to find a way to change it. Because what you have said to us, you black people said to us, there is such a thing as white jobs and black jobs. And whatever the system is that results in this, we gotta attack it in some way, address it in some way. He wasn't a strong advocate, but he was taking the right position, recognizing that something is wrong. And he said, I'm gonna do this, and it's not unusual. I found this very familiar later as I worked in the region around the region. He said, what I think I will do is first of all I want you all to continue to work with me. I'm going to increase my staff by one, at least one secretary. And he said, what many white people say, I want you to get me attractive. He didn't say fair skin, but we understand the code word. I want you to find me an attractive black woman, and I'm going to put in my office, and that will let people know that I really mean business. We're going to bring more black people in different kinds of jobs in City Hall, and that's my way of making that message you think that's a good, wasn't a bad move to make. And in addition to that, he accepted our recommendation that he ought to call all his department heads together once a month, invite us to come in, you ought to call the roll. What have you done on this issue since that time? That was starting. That's very significant. Now that drew, you know, he's willing, but he was bold enough and independent enough in his own thinking to be a decent person. I feel good about that.
How about when Jackson came into to being mayor?
So Jackson came in as a vice mayor.
I mean, when he came in as mayor, what do you think that made a difference?
It made a great difference.
Going from Allen to Michelle to Jackson, there was a big split in terms of how Bronson treated.
Nair was a decent dude, always opened his door, felt comfortable with him, he's a reasonable man. I liked him, like him now, he and Allen, you know, there's some 30 or 50 more than Marta. We were very comfortable with him. His attitude was right, he felt he was a decent man.
Yeah.
He felt that his general attitude about race was different, his tone, his background and so forth was different.
So
this is Michelle. He wasn't that upper class, rich wasp that had been running the world, or running this part of our world. And he didn't, he felt comfortable with black people, Marcel did, and we felt comfortable with Marcel. He did what he could, we felt he had a friend willing to listen to do what he could in a hostile environment.
Yeah.
That's the way I was talking about. I liked him. And then Nina came on with Nice Man. He took, Nina Jackson took a very strong black posture, and he was identifying with black cause, he was identifying with black community, which is highly regarded in black community, and not so highly regarded in white community.
Yeah.
When he came in, I guess 75% of the jobs, I would roughly say, were held by white people in City Hall.
He came with Allen and Michelle.
Yeah, it moved, but you know, it was the old South when he left, although I told you he was trying to change, didn't change. When Maynard came in, he made a difference. He stayed in mayor 8 years. He came in about, I'm guessing at this now, I would say close to 75% of the job, meaningful jobs were held by white people, regardless of the classification of the job, you know, middle and up were white. When he left, they shifted the organization. About 60-75% of the people working in City Hall were black people in the area. A significant difference. Let me give you just one example of what a person who's committed to doing something about it, because he represents that number of the population. Black people didn't like it. Black people thought he was doing, some thought he was going too far. I think he did what he had to do at the time, and did a damn good job. I hold him very high regard for changing the system.
Yeah.
I believe not in a job. Even the Urban League has shifted from helping get a job for individuals to dealing with changing the system. And he helped to change the system. He wanted an example. He had such a hard time in the water department, I believe, sanitary department. He found a black engineer. But Braskin is doing the job detectives with a problem. Just going. Why you can't go? Brain, a bad thing to do is go on judge attack. I mean, pick on judge attack. I mean, it was
better
on
the
system. That's what I'm saying. And he found a black dude who had all the credentials down in the Bahamas someplace, the Caribbean. He brought him up here and made him head of the damn water park. Found him. So I kid my white friends when I talk about it around the country. That black people are physically different in one way. Black people can see better than white people, have better vision.
So you personally had with Jackson a real advocate, somebody who was really...
With Jackson?
Yeah, with Jackson. Somebody
he was
really good. Really he was pushing for blacks.
Yeah, advocate. But he lost, he lost not the word. He did not have the warm support of the white business community because he was selling them out. Respectful. He was respectful, dude, but he didn't care too much about that.
Why do you think the white business community opposed him? Because he was giving too many jobs to blacks?
Yeah, it was too much of a strong advocate for black interests.
How about the minority contractor? They must have got pretty angry at him for that too, I suppose.
Yes. He brought in the whole question of minority contracting, and the city council, you know, set up a system of set-asides, and the whole question of encouraging blacks to get a piece of action became a part of his administration. He identified with it, and it worked across the board, and the council ultimately, when you had a few more blacks on the board, that went along with him, and changes have been brought about. And the whole attitude about Atlanta and the black world nationwide is very positive in terms of Atlanta having great opportunities for the black profession to come
together. So it was really important to get a black mayor, man. No matter what Allen or Michelle did, they still sort of in a white viewpoint. It was really important to get somebody black in there.
In my judgment, unquestionably.
Yeah. Yeah,
it would have changed. It was changing.
Yeah, but it was
God knows.
Right.
You go to City Hall in my early days, I'm talking about, we mentioned to, I remember my first knowledge of having anything to do with the mayor, I guess my first job, either at college or the university, as an intern, you know, separated toilets, covered water fountain in the City Hall, you know. Just a matter of practice in the sound. And, you know, you start talking about me getting rid of the water and all that kind of stuff. It was just a grave change trying to get black people and white people to recognize it. That wasn't the case. And I was in Clark College, and the buses you're talking about. And, you know, getting on the bus and moving to the back, that was just a part of the traditions of the South of this nation. And that slowly, very slowly began to change. We had our first black bus driver, I recall, Ken Gill, he was telling me, I think 1968. Yeah. Never in the history of Atlanta, when we were talking about in the days with the first mayor that they mentioned, Hartsfield, that I knew, he had to go. I was working at Urban League down Auburn Avenue, and the Brother Street wife right there nearby. And when we approached him about black policemen, he said, as if to say, I can't make no decision on that. We never had a black policeman or a black fireman in Atlanta. And he said, well, they got to do with it. And he finally said, well, I will call some citizens together and discuss it. So before he even began to admit, even as a problem that ought to be addressed, he had public meetings all over the place, particularly in white communities, say, don't you think it's all right, we have some black policemen? Black policemen? It was that kind of attitude. But he felt he needed somebody to say, okay, go ahead, it's okay, get two or three in. And same thing with like the firemen.
So I think it's L.A. That's amazing.
When the Clintons and Premier Hospital finally decided that, I think a black policeman, you got all these black people in town, what the hell is having black policemen? What's wrong with it? He was trying. Now, he didn't have the educational background or the political, or the strength of the business connection that Ivan Allen had. Our man was a sophisticated leader of the business community. So he was the president, I believe, of the Chamber of Commerce. Right. I don't know if I'm mayor or other member, unless he's mayor by virtue of being mayor. And once he finally decided, I'm going to hire these black women, I'm going to put in the black community, black people beating up black people, and we ought to stop that. And I think white people said, well, okay, hire a few. And he hired a few.
He was doing it for votes then, right?
I'm inclined to think that he was doing it for votes, and I understand he said at one time that he couldn't do something, he would meet with black people on Auburn Avenue, but if they got a large enough number of votes, he would consider it. And he wouldn't even come to the meeting, they'd come later. So I would say it's a political reason, and I think he wanted to do something, didn't know what to do, didn't have the power to do it, and finally decided that he better go to the white people. They sort of said, well, I'll hire a few, and he hired a few. Let me tell you the restrictions. Number one, they could wear a uniform only on duty. They had to take it off before they got back on the street. Number two, they could not ride in an automobile in a regular police vehicle. Number three, they checked in at the Butler Street YMC on Auburn Avenue before they had their uniform.
Yeah, I suppose it was Long Cochran.
You did? You okay?
Was Long Cochran,
right? So and many of those were hired. We interviewed. I ran into a little trouble once. I was a young fellow. Somewhere I parked, I didn't have any minutes parked. One violated the law, but the lady was with me, he just sort of parked me, had a little drink or something like that. And the policeman approached me. It's a funny story. I told my wife this one. And a guy comes along, shines his light. Just parked in there. Park? It wasn't parked. And I said, Lord have mercy, what am I doing out here? Park at 9 o'clock at night, and that policeman sneaks up on me. And the guy flashed the light on my face. And I'm about to have a heart attack. He said, hello, Mr. Coleman. I said, hello, sir. He told me about that. Said, everything all right? I said, fine, thank you. He said, okay, I'll see you. One of the policemen that I interviewed with Urban League a long, long time ago, he got his job because he interviewed. What I'm suggesting to you is that it was really another world, another time. Being black in the South, unless you have some strength,
You know, it's tough not to hate Bob Dylan from day one.
Yeah, I'm, you know, the stories I've heard.
You're right. You know, just plain horrible. And it isn't, and it's a different man. A difference now, but
It's hard to give up those old feelings.
That's true. So then we had to go through the same thing with the black firemen. When Maynard Jackson came along, he simply opened up the gate and said, you know, this system is a system. It's not a job. A policeman is a policeman is a policeman. So let's just move. And we old people gotten used to that. But white people have not gotten used to, we found that later, to black leadership. So when Maynard comes on, having him in charge of City Hall, and black people have been running a long time, changing the guard from white to black, was a great challenge to the white people of the matter. And they finally wanted to find a way to get him out, but he would be reelected because of the numbers, the numbers game. And there didn't want to end it, but the numbers again. I think Atlanta finally decided, you know, we can't beat those damn numbers, so what we'll do is set up some other kind of organization. I don't want to name any, but we need our own structure, so you set up something to take care of the white interest. They can run the politics, but we'll run the money, so we can control it in this thing. So I would say that that's where we are now. Not only Atlanta, I think it's certainly true in Chicago, because just recently, you know, what happened that election, Washington's able to tie to get you half and half now.
So you sort of feel that, in other words, there is a partnership now, blacks have the power, politically, whites have the money.
Right, but we have not. I think the blacks have opportunity how to translate political power into economic strength. That's a mixed picture.
Well, it is a mixed picture, that's correct.
And white people, I think the federal government, before Reagan, was beginning through the Civil Rights Commission and through affirmative action. And a Republican, Eisenhower, was reading that, they were the ones who have to recognize that we've got to open up the door, and Nixon even here in the election, open the door, the federal government, give a little bit here. So you did find, I'm sure, that some blacks were able to compete because it's not an easy matter competing for contracts and jobs and so forth. And sure, you want to find whites, you want to open up because blacks haven't had that experience. But I think that's all a part of the growth and development of the nation economically to get blacks into a piece of pie. I think that we will be moving in the right direction and in due course.
We may have some sense of getting stability. I hope so. I get the feeling that no matter what main direction was going to do, the first black mayor, we'll have brought into confrontation with the white man.
Probably, but we did have this great advantage. Number one, he's trained.
Yeah.
Number two, he's articulate. Yeah. Number three, he feels good about himself. Number four, his daddy, remember my church, his daddy was a minister, and he felt good about himself. He had an educated father, and he's an educated man, and he feels independent and feels good about who he is. And he didn't give a damn. He didn't have to care. He didn't have the burden that some other blacks may have had at the time. And in a sense, the same is true of Andy.
Yeah. He still feels a little sensitive. He's the only one that hasn't been able to get an interview. Who was that?
Maynard Jackson. He still doesn't want to talk about that period. He seems to be very reluctant to...
He may be done something to say.
I don't know. Maybe he is. I don't know if he's the only one I've been able to get to. I've spoken to...
He's a good man. I hold him in the very highest regard.
I think he did a great job.
And he did a good job. He did a good job. He's one of the best in the country.
He did a plain old job.
He did indeed. And he felt good about it. I think the key thing is he really didn't have to make compromises. He didn't think he had to make compromise. No. He didn't give a damn.
Well, he did to a certain extent. The whites still had the money power. He did have to make some certain compromises, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we had to make adjustments in relating to the money power, I'm sure. What I meant was that, in a broader aspect of his leadership in City Hall, he felt good about himself and never had to tap dance.
Yeah.
He might have to shift gears from here to there, but he felt good in any circles, and feels comfortable in his circles and doesn't feel any sense of inadequacy. And I think that personal feeling of worth has helped him.
Oh, geez, you're very confident.
Yeah, he's very glad. That's a good word. Very confident. Right. And Andy is too.
Yeah, he is. I want to get back to the schools. I just want to make sure I got that straight in my mind. Was there any reports done showing up that the Board of Education was putting black schools in areas to direct the black population flow? Do you have anything that was ever written down on that?
The only question I was calling on was that, like I mentioned, they're conceiving, and I gave you some help on that. Calling Robert Thompson.
Yeah. He do more and knows more about the housing patterns and help the urban major set up a department locally, and also we set up a department nationally dealing with housing, anybody else like the right.
He may
be very helpful in that.
Yeah.
But it's pretty obvious as you look at the school now, it turns out those same damn schools. You see, when you integrate the school, you don't need the black one.
Right.
And now the city government, now with a black superintendent, they don't want to have two of them.
So in other words, they were building black schools.
It keeps the black people out, you know.
They built black schools to keep the blacks in certain areas.
Right.
Now, they didn't care how the blacks got to that school. They didn't provide bus service, right?
No. Niggas is niggas. You know, we just try to do the best we can to keep this place as long as possible.
In other words, if there's one high school, if there's Washington High School built on the west side, and you live on the east side, you have to get there any way you want.
Yeah,
right?
They did. That's right.
And, and let's say Washington High was here, and let's say the white neighbor was here, then they sure to build no black public schools right around the white area.
That's right.
Now, how about when the schools began to be desegregated, and there was transitional neighborhoods?
What they're doing, still doing, closing.
Let me tell you what the black administration attempted to do to integrate the black schools.
Yeah.
So well, if the whites had moved to the county or whatever, and Central City, blacks come to the Central City for survival. I came from Carterville, Georgia. I thought about Carterville, Georgia, come to Lineville, and I was a whole lot better than Carterville. Okay. Carterville school, when my mother and daddy went to school in Carterville, Georgia, the high school for blacks went to the 11th grade and you graduated. And high school for white people went to the 12th grade and you graduated. My mother's older sister had one child. One of her ambitions was that her daughter in Carterville, Georgia, who wanted to be a school teacher, ought to get that 12th grade. So, and the only place to get a 12th grade education for black folks in Georgia was Washington High School in Atlanta, the only one in the state. So she moved to Atlanta and worked with the telephone company as a maid at $5 a week and sent that daughter to Washington High School to graduate again in 12th grade. When she got here, she found out for the first time in her life there's something called normal. Normal was something like a junior college level. You can go to school for 2 years and graduate, and black folks, the kind of people were teaching black. And once she got into that, then they understood that 2 years beyond that, you can go to college. So she sent her to high school for the second, for the 12th grade, the mom and little Clark College, and graduated from Clark College, which I also graduated, all the rest of my family after that. And she was able to come to South Georgia. Otherwise, Clarksville, Georgia, we'd still be down in Clarksville, Georgia, doing a fact of nothing.
Yeah.
My wife is a school teacher. What the wireless system wanted to do was to try to build a better school in the black community. And they wanted to integrate the black schools. Since the students wouldn't leave, they were going to send white integrated faculty to 60s.
Right.
And the later years. And my wife is a good example. They sent three teachers to teach at the school that my wife was teaching there. And they just show you the problem we face trying to integrate a situation like that. Most of the young teachers, the older teachers, white teachers wouldn't want to go. They asked for volunteers. And the young black one, we had one black lady who came, a good friend of my wife, and my wife and I were able to relate because we felt a little confident about it. We lived in a neighborhood, but it'd come in for lunch sometime. We got to be good friends. We'd go that way and we'd come down and we'd go to homes and we'd play fires and we'd have that. We'd be able to develop a friendly relationship. But the black principal in school stopped having PTA meetings because the white teacher wouldn't come. Now the principal we were talking to, didn't tell him it was a very practical deal. So, you know, I'm not married. Now, I live on the north side, and the fact that PTA meeting is 7 o'clock, and what happens if I drive out here and she asked this question, she said, we're going to have a flat tire and run out of gas, and there's nothing but black service stations out here.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Well, you go and get some damn gas. But she had a real fear of having a flat tire in the black community. She said, now, damn, now. I told my mom and daddy that, and I'm out here alone, Bart, sitting in the rocking bar,
I got to call you, I got to go to some home, and I don't know, it ain't hotel. And there's a fear of her being alone. So so in order to keep the white teachers in the black school, they still have PTSD. And otherwise, they had to penalize the black ones and make the black ones, black teachers to come.
Yeah.
They couldn't do that, they didn't make the white ones come.
It was the young white teacher that was put into the black school. Right?
Yeah, every once in a while, either the young or very old, that nobody else wanted.
I heard also from someplace else that in order to give a sort of a semblance of integrated teaching, that they took some of the better black teachers and put them up in the white schools.
And some of them, and during the integration day, they sent them a black students and put them in the white school.
In other words,
I had daughters out at Turner High School. We lived near there, and my wife's a teacher, so you could manipulate the system if you want to work at it.
Yeah.
And we said, what the hell, we go to Turner High because it was there. But they actually came through and said to the principal, you know, he wants to live with the system, whatever that is. He said, you know, we want some kids, you know, 10 or 12 to go to school X. Now, don't send any children out there, not going to look good for us. So we get the cute little kid, they're all filled up, and they're all starched up, and they smile.
They took the best because
damn right, and sit them out here. Now, here's six to go. When you go over there now, listen, you go, you do good now, because you're representing all of us. And so you get a rocked impression of the situation. And once they go there, then the whole question is, I have a granddaughter, my daughter, who plays part of the development, she has a child at 11, and she goes to private school. And it's remarkable. She was just 90% white. And she had a birthday party just recently. And she advised the white ones in the black community to come. And we were wondering what but we were very pleasantly surprised there. She had about 12, and they spent the night, at the weekend as a matter of fact. And the parents didn't worry about it.
That's
they brought their children and left them there, and they jumped up and down and did what had fun.
I think things have changed.
Carl didn't really make a difference. You're pleased about
that. I think things have changed.
All right.
How about with the transitional schools now? There were some schools, Rattler and, let's say, Cascade Heights, where the neighborhood became black. There were still whites there. There was an effort to close the neighborhood as an interracial neighborhood and hold the school as an interracial school. I know the SWAP organization was active out there. Was there anything that the city or the Board of Education was doing to try and maintain an interracial neighborhood or an interracial school? Or did they just say, the hell with it, and let the whites move out and let the blacks come in?
My guess would be that the Board of Education would do what you wanted to do. I know what Ben right now, he's a good man, he's a good friend. And I know they've struggled with that kind of question. They'd be very much interested in trying to maintain good school system. Very difficult to do with so few whites. The whites are moving away.
How about in the 60s though?
I would say then it was probably, I think that would have been there. I think they figured federal funds and the attitude about it, and the mayor is trying to do something, and the town is trying to, is too busy to hate with us, let's sort of hold it together. So I think that even without saying so or putting it in writing, I think there was very definitely an indication that we want to do everything we can to build this as a school of excellence.
Let me tell you what I heard, and this is still one, I guess, that school superintendent that you mentioned, that woman was
Howard Gale.
Yeah. First of all, after the Brown decision in 54, there was a flurry of activity to upgrade the black schools that they wouldn't want to integrate with whites. And the other thing was that when blacks began to come into white neighborhoods and the schools began to see a mixture of both, that the Board of Education allowed that school to deteriorate, thereby allowing the neighborhood to move over to a black neighborhood more quickly, getting the whites out, but there wasn't any commitment to holding that school.
I have no reason to doubt that those kind of schematics were going on all the time, at every level, and I think it was an understanding since slavery until now, that we got to keep them in their place, and they want to be by themselves, and it's been that way, you're happy and they're happy, so don't mess with it, don't try to change it. And the numbers are too great in any event, so let's sort of keep things like that as long as humanly possible. The other thing, illegal if necessary, legal when you have to, and then just use a pressure of a variety of kinds when you can't do anything else.
Well, what they were illegal was just sort of neglect. They neglected the schools, so everybody was dissatisfied with it, and the white said, let's move someplace else. And the school became all black, and the neighborhood became all black, and pretty much, what holds most people to the neighborhoods, the schools?
school begins to deteriorate, the people move. And that seemed to be Gerald's attitude.
I think the question was a racial attitude, a racist attitude, and that attitude, the design, whatever could be done to maintain a separate society. If it cost money, fine. If it didn't cost money, even better.
And this was going on beyond Allen. Allen may have not supported this.
Unquestionably.
It was going on anyway.
Without his assistance or encouragement of, I think, the society in general. And I think black people just accepted it. The thing that we did in our own family is, you know, you try to do what you can to try to change the system. You continue to work at it. Try to do everything you can to develop yourself, to compete, and look too far ahead of it. But never give up on the chance to really work at it. We, for example, now, this very morning, I did not aboard. It was really pictures been set up.
Yeah.
We're struggling trying to figure out what to do with Parker Creek.
Oh, yeah.
I don't consider this a struggle. We had a very heated discussion, friendly though, with my peers this morning about what we ought to do. It just happened that the person that took the part of you that we can't do this in Parker Creek because it just didn't make sense economically. And I agreed we ought to do the same thing there. We were coming from entirely different points of view.
That's a long time promise that they were
15 years.
Yeah.
Well, they promised heavy rail.
That's right.
And they promised to do it in a hurry. And the point that I made over there, and I don't mind making it on this record either, that we voted the committee of 50. I'm only one new on the board, 17 of the board members that make up that 50. And there was a push by some members of the committee of 50, including my chairman. He understand that I made this comment that he would make it again. That we voted before I think we got enough information to start voting on priorities. But you also vote, and you did vote, to upgrade the system to our 400 on the north side, which originally was set up in a referendum for buses. We voted to upgrade that to a rail system. When I tried to tie the two together to go try to get Parker Creek up to stabilize our thinking about what we're going to do in Parker Creek, at least to go with a rail system, we weren't able to get that across. We're still fighting that battle.
Which is, I remember that when the original model referendum was just in the past, 15 years ago.
Heavy rails.
That was a promise made to the Black
Party. It was indeed. And that's what we're discussing now. It's been a long time. We decided on that 2 weeks from now. With a strong feeling, not necessarily by Chairman David Chesson, I'm not blaming him for that. I think it's the community feeling that the community is dead, is dying, is gone, and just because we promised it 15 years ago, we did it then because it was a thriving community and we hoped it was going to be different, but it's not different, and you know, we hope it'll go away. You know, what we're going to send out there is hogs and buggers, the best we can do.
Well,
at least a bus system.
Because the problem should have been until 15 years ago, that's true.
That's true, that's right. Sometimes between now and then.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah.
So we're working on that.
That's it.
Racial relations improved slightly.
I think it's improved too, but you know, it's
slightly.
That tremendous white fight out of the city during that period really hurt, I think.
We're still facing it tomorrow. I see it all the time.
Yeah,
which way do you go? Your schools and modern and university?
I think the feeling I got from, I think what probably should have been done rather than giving students the choice of where they want to transfer to in terms of school, I think the Board of Education should have just made a massive reassignment policy and said, you white kids go here, you black kids go here, and I think they would have been able to integrate the system that way instead of just saying, well, put an application for where you want to go and we'll approve it or we'll not approve it.
Well, all designed to slow it down as far as possible and hope things will never change.
It seemed to me that's what it
was. And it didn't change too much yet. And the economics of this thing is still a very serious problem. Now, how the blacks can take the numbers that was given from strength politically and translate that in economic terms is the next big push in my judgment.
Well, I mean, we hit the city leader, the insurance company, with Herman Russell's insurance company, this is the city where with black schools.
Yeah. And the numbers and the schools.
Yeah.
And you do have, you know, the four undergraduate schools, and you have a medical school that's new, and then you have the London University where I work, and you have the Interdenomination Theological Center, all in the center together.
Yeah.
But the point that we must make is why Georgia State has 25,000 students there about. And we have 10 or 12 in the University Central here. Cheaper to go to Georgia State. When I talk to students who go to Georgia State, they're not really not part of the system. Unless you're a football player, athlete, you can make some money and look good, it's fine. As far as really caring, as far as integrating, as far as trying to build a community where the students ought to have respect and have a social and cultural and educational environment that is mutually beneficial, there's a lot to be desired. You just ought to grow, and you got some blacks in the classroom, but if the system doesn't do something to try to encourage
nothing will happen.
Right. I know one friend of mine who went to Georgia Tech has doctorate now, teaching us, Gill, Dr. Gill, went to Georgia Tech, that was a very good friend, he was so good, he finished something like, I guess, 7 in the top 10 as far as maybe the top 3 of his name. He was one of the D's. You're an appendage. You're not a part of the system.
What can we do to do something about that?
I think somewhere along the line, you ought to work for it. But that's also not only an economic question, but there are many social and cultural goals that are closed that we need to address.
So there should be more focus for the whole focus of schools. So, that's a major
once they're there, I hope that we wouldn't have to do what Kemp had to do in dealing with the athletes that are attracted to Alabama and the other schools itself for their superstars in football and basketball, but where the school would legitimately deal with the economic problem. So if you have a segregated school around the ghetto,
that
we were talking about, but the teachers who go there don't want to go, and you don't motivate the kids to develop their full potential, and one day they get in college, whatever college, black or white, there's a need to try to deal with that educational dilemma, which is really a negative educational service for black people. We got to try to figure out what to do about that.
Well,
I'm troubled by it.
The black kids I've taught at Georgia Tech have been pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, the black kids. And, I don't know how much they fit in socially or anything.
I understand.
But
we have handled the problem. But I was thinking about those who you may get the goodies, but the ones who just not quite as good. Now the black university has taken on roles, and now I'm on the board of college and school, and we have a new member that spoke up the other day. He says, I hope that the black college will not forget that it has a major responsibility to deal with the students who have difficulty getting out of places. And just because the student is a C or D plus student, I was not good in college, but I thought good one to class. I thought at home. I thought they wanted me. At home, the teachers are supporting me. If something goes wrong, they call me in. It's a good feeling. This is my place. And when you get that feeling, although you might not have been motivated back in high school, you may get motivated somewhere along the line because someone cares. Now, if you treat the student because whether you're good or not and you pass examination, is a different question, but there's a feeling of care. And this fellow was saying to us, we need to be damn sure at Clark College and Morehouse, Marshtown, and Spartan Colleges, we need to take to that student who may not be able to compete in that environment. I remember when I went to AU, I had one teacher that helped me to understand that. We assign our students in social work, like the medical profession, you're assigned as an intern in a social service agency where you're taught by a trained social worker and supervised by your school. And this teacher, my supervisor, my teacher supervisor, and also she was a head of mine, what we call my field work program, where I did my work at the IAMU. But she had a student who came from Cottonwood, Georgia, my hometown, and never been to a big town, and they went through college and hadn't been anywhere, done anything, and don't know anybody, how to operate. She would talk to that student and try to figure out, where should I send this particular student in this day and time, a black female, 23. She'd take them and pick them up and send them straight to Chicago with a big enough institution where the black and blacks working together to learn something about the dynamics of living in a bigger world. Otherwise, even college, you wouldn't learn a damn thing. So it's a question of, this woman put me at the local level news. she sent me on a tour of places, and then found equipment there that was just right for what I was interested in. I also did a field work placement under Warren Cochran's office. I don't know an awful lot more about him. But Warren Cochran was a hell of an operator. I didn't like him, but I learned a hell of a lot how to operate. He's an autocrat. I mean, he would do it to you, but he had a fellow there who's now the dean of school social at Duke University, who's my supervisor. And I learned an awful lot of how to run an operation.
That's good
to learn.
Well, you know, so that's about all what I want to get into. I really understand what you said about the school system. That's something I haven't really been able to find out. There's so much of this stuff that's behind the scenes that's not available to really read or to grasp. You know, that's why school
systems are good. An individual who just might have been bad would be very good.
Now think about it. If I come up with a name of someone who's intimately acquainted with that situation, I'd be happy.
Yeah. If I was looking at the Board of Education records, if they would say anything about where they were, I guess I'd go to where they were building it, just flat school, to see if they were, in terms of where the neighborhoods were, moving.
I
don't
think about that.
Basically, they were trying to build a black school away from any white neighborhood in effort to.
I think the pattern of the school system is the pattern of the city, the pattern of the community leaders, the pattern of the business community was to do whatever was necessary to move as slowly, to move not at all, but to move as slowly as possible to keep things the way that they were. But you can, and it is a tough, it's been a very tough job.
You've worked the fight, so I mean, you know it.
That's just a tough one. I've known the times, for example, when my first job at the Urban League, I was traveling with the government, and we went down to the state capitol just to sit in the gallery, and I'm inside for black, and inside for white, and we just listened to see what was happening, because we wanted to learn about how we could do a civic education program at the local Urban League, which is, you know, this is my job, and I'm going to try to technically organize a black community and let the black community take care of itself. That was technically actually what my first group. And I want to go down, you know, to check it out, to learn what I thought about how I operate and see the some rednecks from down south. But they just opened up to them and they were all over the place. So it was a good bad guy. Not a black guy, and I was there together. So I walked over and went right where we went. You know, go and look from the balcony and see the legislation system. He's the album advisor. So, we ain't after your advice. There were a whole lot of rednecks around, you know. He used his common sense too. And he just thought it was going to fly. He just thought it was still going to be a good big deal. And they were all over the damn place. They're coming out here to protect time and stuff. And he's a fight. We brought it in. It's just, racism is alive and very well. It has been for long. And still is. I know it is. It is. My church is, my Baptist, and with the churches, we celebrated our 120th anniversary, I think, last Sunday. We've been around a long time. Because this time is better than most. Because racism is alive and doing very well.
Well, the ghost city could visit the haters.
But I like it. I moved to New York. I like New York City.
I love New York. That's my hometown.
Lived in Manhattan, right near the Avenue office, which is on York and 60th.
Yeah.
And 67th Street. And I was dragging my life to New York City. But I was dragging back to Atlanta. Going to Vermont, and I'm going to New York. My wife and John and both got a dog in New Jersey. But you know what? Black people in New York haven't done this with them in Atlanta. They don't have any political power in New York. I think the Jewish community, I think Koch and the Hispanic community are cooked up a deal. Because Koch is an independent fellow. He don't give a damn about nobody.
Yeah. I think Koch is on his way out.
I think so. But he didn't believe in relationship as well as some other
things. I think the couple of them, yeah.
John Russell Dodd is dead.
Yeah, he's gone. But his papers are available, actually.
Okay.
Spoke to Reverend Borders.
Okay, all right.
He doesn't remember all that much. He's getting caught all
the time.
He's
a great spokesman in there.
Oh, yeah. He heard a lot about
Republican, too. He made him survive.
Spoke to C.S. Scott.
C.S. Scott, yeah. God have mercy.
You don't meet too many black conservatives out there, man.
Yeah, you.
He got the time he wanted to be Republican.
Yeah.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. We did organize one other effort that we did with Jesse Hill, Dr. Clint Warner, Herman Russell, one of our main young friend of mine, Carl Holden.
Carl
Holden, the president of the United States.
He's
in the line of
business. He's working
on it. No, in Washington.
He's in Washington, yeah.
The five of us, all playing different kinds of roles.
So you
had the mercy to organize the line of inquiry, didn't they?
Okay.
And we organized the line of inquiry for a civil rights reason. Scott just changed over to the Republican Party. He wouldn't threaten to lose his report, I think. And the Constitution, they weren't responding to our needs for black news. And we simply organized the anchor. I was the Secretary of War, the Justice was the Chairman, Russell was the President.
So you were one of the Young Turks, I guess, in the...
We said, hey, well, yeah, we do what we damn please. We organize our own paper.
Did you get a lot of...
We organize papers, yeah, fine.
Did you get a lot of flack from the old-time business, or old-time black community leaders at all, from Dobbs, from Walton, from...
No, we didn't give a damn, because we'd already decided we were going to replace him anyway. But one of those history, we decided that the summit conference, although Walton was one convenient, we decided that one thing we needed to do, and to follow our judgment, that we get rid of the voters maybe because they were not moving fast. And we really replaced that group. And Justice Hill and Herman and all of us went out different ways, but we haven't given the kind of leadership that somebody asked me the other day, that from McKinley, even yesterday at lunchtime, Seminary, we desperately need, in his judgment, and I share that with you, a group of black leaders to do what the voters maybe one time did. The voters made at one time, let's say 25 or 30 people, you know that for a while. Nobody, black and white, ran for political office in Atlanta unless they say, well, the voters made at that age. That's why I wrote it up to step along. When a ticket, we call it, that's not the word we use. Yeah, ticket was signed by A.T. Waller and got turned out of town. We'd have one of those on everybody's doorstep on election day. People voted down 99.95%. They followed, quote, the black ticket. That's what the department, that's it. And that fellow was telling me there's a need. You got a lot of loose end politicians who you think are people who are trying to have some effect on the political fabric, who have narrow interest in them here. And we ought to come up, some of us telling me, out of that, Joe Lowry and this guy McKinley. We're thinking about trying to get together, maybe.
Do you think there was a support in the public community when the inquiry first came out in terms of you people supporting sit-ins and the older people not going?
No, they thought we were high at it. We got, I thought, general support. We issued that ACLA report. They liked names.
So there was no big support in the
public. No. We had what we call the Young Turks, all the guys now, but at that time we said, yeah, we're taking over.
Yeah.
And now what we think we've done, we took over and moved, but it's time for others now to come on and we sort of tore up that old, and then we got too involved in things and became independent on our own way. And I moved up from town. I feel as organization, so I could have a little something just in order to make money and to run the business aspect of it. But we don't have the ones who might be able to work with the community. I'm taking over this as of last week. I get to make announcements on it. You know that might be in
here? Oh, sure.
You know, we get through council with
you. Yeah,
Geraldine Council.
Okay,
Jordan was running this at one time?
Yeah.
Wilder Brantham?
Yeah.
I plan to go to Washington next week and talk to him about it.
I thought you were in trouble with some money.
I had a party, I wanted to have a meeting. You said he did the other day, five people, and I pulled away to get some goodies and they passed some drinks and stuff. She looked at me and said, I'm sorry.
We're going to try to put it together. I hope so. I think it's good organization. But you don't think there's any big support in the black community over the sittings or over the tactics that some of the students were engaging in? Yes, so I've always heard that the Dobbs and the Waltons were sort of annoyed that somebody was trying to take over their power, and they were annoyed.
They didn't. They just weren't able to deal with it. I didn't conceive it to be anything that was worthy of serious thought.
That was
cute because time, Jesse started moving and Russell started moving up and Carl Holden was the editor of the paper and he had Union Bond in place. And the thing just moved. All of us took on bigger and broader issues.
So it wasn't that big of a sport if there wasn't
any. I didn't consider it.
Was it Inquirer World of Business?
Why didn't it?
When and why?
It didn't. It's still operating.
Is it still operating?
Yeah, it's still operating.
I haven't seen it at all.
I think what we did is Jesse and Herman. Matter of fact, I got a check the other day. I didn't get a letter from him. I didn't put on the damn letter the road because I didn't. It started moving in the business direction in my judgment. It's just me. And I wasn't interested, I didn't enter into it, but as far as I'm concerned, it was an instrument for social change, or for system change, which is my interest. And I ain't gonna be bothered with it, but they sent me I gave my stock to somebody in the family. But I didn't realize I didn't give it all away. They sent me a check for $100 over there. I said, what the hell is this?
I got to give you more I didn't know stock or anything. I read the earlier issues. I didn't think it was too.
It would be too busy. You got a fellow named Smith that runs it.
Yeah.
If somebody want to come in and take it and make something out of it, it could be a big operation.
Now, I've read the Daily World lately. I know that's the company I'd start, but. It's
community. Yeah, right.
It's read it. Socially, yeah, that's all. I mean, that's politically.
But politically, I think Inquirer could be. But,
I think you need a...
And the voice came on after that.
Yeah,
the guy in the voice is the one who worked with us to get this one. He's a cripple. Let me know how you come along.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot.